They say the greatest manipulators never raise their voice. They raise your doubts. My name is Isaac, and I used to be a student of psychology until I became its darkest subject. I didn't just mirror emotions. I rewrote realities. I made people question their memories, abandon their truths, and love me for the pain I gave them. From gaslighting to guilt-tripping, emotional starvation to reward control, I didn't ruin lives with fists. I did it with silence, timing, and perfectly placed apologies. But the biggest lie I ever told was the one I told myself. If you think you know who's pulling the strings, think again. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you The Switch, How I Became the Manipulator. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Smile That Lied. Technique, mirroring and flattery. I still remember the way her lips curled when she smiled. Not wide, not open, just enough to give you the illusion of warmth. Enough to make you feel seen, special, chosen. The kind of smile that had razors hidden beneath the curve, if you knew where to look. But back then, I didn't know. Not yet. They say the biggest lies are the ones we tell ourselves. That's horseshit. The biggest lies are the ones we believe, because someone makes us want to. And it all started with that smile. Hers. Then mine. I was 21. Psychology undergrad. Slightly broke, slightly brilliant, and fully convinced that I was better than the rest of the sheep in my cohort. I didn't party. I didn't flirt. I studied the mind like it was a blueprint for world domination. Because in my world, information wasn't just power. It was the leverage no one saw coming. I wasn't born manipulative. I became it. Slowly. Deliberately. Out of necessity. When you've grown up invisible in a house full of screaming people, parents who yelled to be heard but never listened, you learn the power of silence. You study faces. You learn when a smile means danger. You learn how to mimic it just right so no one ever suspects how much you hate them. So yeah, when I sat down in the third row of Cognitive Psych 201 and saw Professor Talia Grant for the first time, I didn't fall in love. I took notes. She was mid-30s, maybe early 40s, the kind of beautiful that demanded silence before she even opened her mouth. Not loud beautiful, controlled beautiful. Blazer always fitted, hair never out of place. She carried herself like someone who never begged to be listened to. People just shut up when she entered the room. I watched her, and I mirrored her. That day, her left hand held the edge of the desk when she spoke. I started doing the same by week two. She always crossed her legs to the right when she sat. So did I. She tilted her head slightly when she questioned a student's answer. I mimicked that too. Only I did it when she spoke, enough to intrigue her. Enough to get noticed without seeming desperate. Mirroring, the oldest psychological trick in the book. But when done right, it's fucking magic. I needed office hours. Not because I was failing, God no. I had the highest score in the class. But I needed access, proximity, vulnerability. So I made one up. Professor Grant, I'm struggling with the module on pattern recognition biases, I said, shifting my voice into just the right mix of confident and confused. The way our brains shortcut logic, it's fascinating, but kind of terrifying, right? She looked up from her laptop, and there it was, the smile. Terrifying? That's an interesting way to put it, she said, head tilted, voice soft, curious. Bingo. She offered me tea. I declined. I needed to look in control, not like a student fumbling for connection. She offered a seat across from her. I adjusted my posture to match hers exactly. She leaned in. So did I. Her tone dropped to a whisper when she explained neural shortcuts. So did mine when I asked about applications in real life. At one point, I said, I've been practicing emotional mapping, watching how people react to tone, eye contact, body shifts. Feels like I'm seeing people in X-ray. She blinked. Just once. You're doing independent research? Only the informal kind, I said, smiling back at her. Her kind of smile. And that's when it happened. Her gaze lingered too long. You know that pause people do when they're either trying not to fuck up or try not to fantasize. That one. She cleared her throat, looked away, adjusted a pen that didn't need adjusting. I walked out of that office with no study help, but I left with something better. Control. Over the next few weeks, I deepened the bond. I escalated slowly. Each class, I'd find new ways to reflect her. Not just physically, emotionally. When she was tired, I let my voice lag like hers. When she seemed upbeat, I mirrored her energy. I read her moods like they were road signs, and I never missed a turn. Then I planted the seed. I left a copy of Robert Greene's The Art of Seduction on her desk. No note, just the book, highlighter marked pages. One in particular, the section on intellectual seduction. She found it during a break, looked around the empty lecture hall. I watched from behind the double doors. I saw her smile. Again, not the professor one, the other one. Later that week, she emailed me. Subject: interesting choice of reading material. Body: we should discuss this off the record. Hook, line, sinker: we started meeting in cafes. At first, it was under the guise of mentorship. She wanted to nurture my passion for psychology. But then came the side glances, the accidental touches, the wine instead of coffee, the laughter that lingered a little too long, the conversations that started sounding less like lessons and more like foreplay. I gave her space to talk, echoed her deepest insecurities back with just enough compassion to make her feel exposed, but safe. I played the student, the innocent, the one who just wanted to learn. And when she finally leaned in one night, her breath sweet with red wine, and kissed me outside the dimly lit bar, I didn't feel butterflies. I felt validation, because I hadn't just mirrored her smile. I had rewritten it. But this wasn't about sex. Not really. This was a test. A live experiment. I wanted to see how far I could bend someone before they broke. I wanted to feel the moment a person switched from skeptic to servant, without ever realizing it. And Talia broke beautifully. Within weeks, she was texting at midnight, asking where I was, confessing things, sharing dreams, fantasies, secrets, trauma. I soaked it all up like a sponge and reflected it back as compassion. That's the trick. You don't overpower people. You let them pour into you until they believe you're the only one who understands them. That's when they stop guarding themselves. That's when they hand you the keys. I had complete access to her life, passwords, thoughts, hopes, her deepest fears. She told me her marriage had failed because her ex never saw her. I made sure she always felt seen. She said she used to feel powerful in her 20s. I told her I saw that woman still in her. She cried. I held her. And when I whispered, "You make me feel safe," she kissed me harder. She had no idea I was just playing back her own script. But here's the twist. The more I manipulated others, the more I started questioning myself. Not out of guilt, out of curiosity. I stood in front of my mirror one night, practicing smiles. Hers, mine, versions of me I didn't even recognize anymore. My face felt like a mask factory. I could be charming, broken, dominant, submissive, curious, cold. And for the first time, I asked myself a question I couldn't answer. Which one of these is me? Talia eventually spiraled. She grew needy, paranoid, obsessed. When I pulled back, she chased harder. When I disappeared, she wept. And me? I felt nothing. Not guilt. Not joy. Just fascination. She thought I was her weakness. But really? She was my training wheels. That smile, the one that lied, was never hers. It was mine. She just wore it first. Chapter 2, Echo Chambers. Technique: confirmation bias and social reinforcement. If chapter 1 was about the smile that lied, then this chapter, this fucking chapter, is about the voices that echoed back what I wanted to hear. Voices I curated, crafted, controlled. Let me say this clearly. People don't want the truth. They want proof that they were right all along. And if you can give them that, you can own them. It started with Laurel. She wasn't a professor. She wasn't older. She wasn't powerful. Laurel was my age. Smart, observant, shy, and unknowingly perfect for what I wanted next, a controlled environment, a living subject, a test case. Laurel sat beside me in behavioral neuroscience, always with her sleeves tugged over her hands, a thermos clutched like a lifeline, and her eyes down until the professor asked a question. Then, she lit up. Her voice would tremble, but her answers, always correct. I saw the potential in her immediately. What she lacked in confidence, she made up for in curiosity. And curiosity is a fucking gateway drug. I started small. One day after class, I leaned over and whispered, "You always answer the questions I was too scared to say out loud." She blinked, startled. Then she smiled, uncertain, but touched. That was all I needed. I complimented her intellect, not her looks. I made her feel seen beyond the surface. And in return, she began to open up. She told me about her anxiety, her overbearing parents, how she never quite fit into friend groups because she was too intense. I told her intensity was a virtue. I told her smart people often feel isolated because they're living in a different frequency. She believed me. Why? Because I wasn't just flattering her. I was confirming the story she already told herself, the quiet one she never said out loud. That's where confirmation bias kicks in. If you tell someone something they already suspect about themselves, good or bad, they cling to it like gospel. Because it feels like truth. Not because it is, but because it resonates. And when it resonates, they start to trust you more than their own instincts. That's what happened with Laurel. And I milked it. I built her a narrative. "You're not broken," I told her one night when she confessed her panic attacks. "You're just more tuned in than the rest of them. They drown in noise. You hear signals." She cried. Not because she was sad, but because no one had ever turned her weaknesses into weapons before. I told her her fear was intuition. Her loneliness was intelligence. Her overthinking was rare awareness. She stopped doubting herself. But here's the catch. She started doubting everyone else. That's the beauty of an echo chamber. It doesn't just validate you. It isolates you. And then it replaces the world with me. I became Laurel's mirror, her mentor, her romantic ideal. Her entire worldview funneled through our conversations. I introduced her to podcasts, books, subreddits, all curated to amplify her beliefs. I'd send her articles about the dangers of emotional repression, videos on gifted child syndrome, books about empath sensitivity. I created a themed world around her pain, then became her only tour guide. And she didn't resist. Why would she? People love the sound of their own voice, especially when they think it's someone else finally understanding them. Here's a darker truth. I wasn't helping Laurel. I was turning her into a case study. Every conversation we had, I logged. Every trigger, every doubt, every pattern, I noted it. I built a mental database around her. I created invisible reinforcement loops. Say something true, get trust. Say something comforting, get admiration. Challenge her slightly, get dependence. Apologize for it, get deeper intimacy. Rinse. Repeat. The more she trusted me, the more she fed the loop. Eventually, she stopped hanging out with her study group. Said they drained her. Stopped calling her sister back. Too negative. By mid-semester, she told me I was the only person who really got her. And just like that, the echo was complete. But let's not pretend I didn't pay a price. Because while I was busy manipulating Laurel, something inside me was changing too. The control, the trust, the access. It felt better than sex. That high? It's addictive. There's something profoundly fucked up about knowing someone would fight their own reality before they ever question you. And once I saw that in Laurel's eyes, the pure, unfiltered belief, I wanted more. We started dating, technically. But it wasn't love. It was an experiment with a heartbeat. She thought we were soulmates. I thought she was a reflection of my skill set. Cold? Maybe. But I didn't see it that way at the time. To me, this was research. A deep dive into how identity forms, how relationships solidify, and how trust gets transferred from self to source. I didn't need a lab. I had Laurel's heart. One night, things went too far. She told me she wanted to drop out of school and reset her life. She said I inspired her. that I showed her the cage she'd been living in. And suddenly, I panicked, because I hadn't built an exit plan. I'd created a dependent system, with no off switch. So I started pulling back, slowly, quietly, delayed responses, fewer compliments, more silence. She noticed. She asked what was wrong. I said, maybe we're too similar. Maybe we've built something that only works in a bubble. She cried again, this time not out of release, but grief. She asked, did I do something wrong? And for the first time in a long time, I felt something. Not guilt, not shame, just a flicker of recognition. I was becoming the cage. The worst part? Even when I hurt her, she defended me. That's just how his mind works, she told her friend on the phone once. He's deep, complicated. No, Laurel. I was bored, and you were a mirror I outgrew. I ended things with a lie, of course. Said I was going through something. Said I needed space to grow. Said it had nothing to do with her. That's the most effective way to break someone, make them feel abandoned but not rejected. She wrote me a 5-page letter after that. I never opened it. I already knew what it would say. Laurel became a ghost in my memory. Another data point. Another case. But the technique? That stuck. Create resonance. Reinforce belief. Replace external validation with me. Echo chambers aren't just environments. They're emotional ecosystems. And once I figured that out, I realized I could do this to anyone. Chapter 3. The Scarcity Illusion. Technique, fear of loss, urgency, and emotional deadline traps. Let me tell you something about human behavior. People don't chase what they already have. They chase what they think they're about to lose. It's not love that binds us. It's the threat of love slipping away. It's the ticking clock. The what if. The last chance. That's the drug. The hook. The leash around the throat. If you want someone to hand you their soul, make them think they're running out of time. Scarcity is the most powerful illusion in the manipulator's arsenal. You don't need to offer anything real. You just need to limit it. Make affection rare. Make attention unpredictable. Be present, then vanish. Flood, then starve. And they'll come crawling. After Laurel, I wasn't looking for another test subject. I needed a break. Or at least, that's what I told myself. But manipulation, it doesn't wait for you to be ready. It feeds on silence, on boredom, on your need to feel something, even if that something is destruction. That's when I met Eli. He was nothing like the others. Tall, magnetic, charismatic in the way that needed no effort. The type of guy people just gravitated toward without realizing why. And the irony? He was a manipulator too. He just didn't call it that. He called it charisma. He called it game. And I let him think that. Because from the moment we met, I knew I wasn't going to mirror him. I was going to outmaneuver him. We met at a psychology symposium downtown. One of those weekend things where everyone drinks overpriced coffee and pretends to be the next Freud. He was speaking on the neuroeconomics of choice paralysis, which already made me suspicious. Anyone that's slick with titles usually compensates for something. But when I approached him after and said, "You almost made loss aversion sound like a dating strategy," he laughed like I'd just told the funniest joke in the world. He clapped me on the shoulder, told me he liked my edge. I smiled, a little too slowly, let the silence hang. Then I walked away. Scarcity. It didn't take long for him to find me again. "Let's grab a drink," he said the next day. "Talk more about that dating strategy line." I hesitated, not out of shyness, but calculation. "Maybe," I replied, "if I don't have other plans." That was the beginning. I never made myself fully available. I never replied instantly. I'd accept invites, then cancel at the last minute. Apologize vaguely. Offer rain checks I never intended to keep. And yet, he kept chasing. The more I pulled away, the more he reached. Because in his world, rejection wasn't real. So when I became the only person not fawning over him, he couldn't breathe. I began to drip-feed him intimacy. One night, I let him in. Not literally, emotionally. I told him something raw, true, about my father, about how he left when I was 11, how he said he'd be back in 3 days, and how every hour after that felt like my skin was peeling from me inside. Eli went quiet. He nodded, touched my hand. "That explains a lot," he said. It was the first time I saw him human. The next day, I ghosted him. Do you get it? The game wasn't about seduction. It was about imbalance. I gave him intensity, then absence. Confession, then silence. I trained him to crave unpredictability, because that's how we're wired. Our brains release more dopamine from intermittent reinforcement than from consistency. Same logic casinos use. Same logic I used. Eli started unraveling faster than I expected. He began texting more often, asking questions I never answered, getting jealous of people I wasn't even spending time with. The more he tried to secure me, the more uncertain I made him feel. He even started performing vulnerability. "I've never felt like this before," he said one night. "With anyone." I smiled, just slightly, because he had no idea the clock was ticking. Then I hit him with the ultimatum. I told him I might be moving, out of the city, maybe across the country. I wasn't sure. I said I needed space to think, to figure out what I want, that I didn't believe in labels, that this wasn't about him. Bullshit. All of it. But the illusion of scarcity? It worked. He started opening up even more, promising things, dreaming out loud, making plans he thought I'd want to hear. He clung to every interaction like it was the last page of his favorite book. And when he finally said, "I can't lose you," I looked him dead in the eyes and said, "You already did." Here's the part one don't tell many people. It wasn't just about the power. It was about the look in their eyes. That exact second where realization blooms like a bruise. Not because they were rejected, but because they never had a chance to begin with. Scarcity does more than manipulate behavior. It rewrites memory. Eli started remembering our time together like it was some perfect, once-in-a-lifetime thing. He romanticized the chaos, turned my absence into mystery, my deflection into depth. That's what we do, isn't it? We don't remember what happened. We remember what hurt, and we wrap it in meaning because the pain has to be worth something. Weeks later, I saw him at another seminar. He smiled, but it was different, hollow. He was standing next to someone else, some new admirer. I watched as he used the same lines, the same lean-in posture, the same charming laugh. I almost admired it. We're all repeating something. The only difference is who's writing the script. I walked past him without saying a word. He turned, called out, "Hey, Isaac." I paused, looked over my shoulder. "Hope you're doing well," he said. I nodded. "You too." And just like that, the moment was gone. But I knew he'd remember it for weeks, wondering what it meant, what he could have said, what he should have done differently. That's the final curse of scarcity. You never stop asking yourself what more you could have done, even when the answer was nothing at all. Chapter 4, Gaslight Gospel. Technique: reality distortion, memory rewriting, and psychological reversal. Let me start this one with a confession. The first time I truly gaslit someone, I didn't know that's what I was doing. I thought I was clarifying, correcting, helping. But you don't really accidentally gaslight someone. Not if you're someone like me. Eventually, it stops being a misstep. It becomes a system, an ecosystem of control built on doubt and watered by silence. The moment I realized how far I could bend someone's version of reality was the moment I knew there were no more rules, no more boundaries, only limits. And limits are made to be pushed. Her name was Camille, and she was dangerous. Not to me, to herself. At first, I didn't plan to manipulate her. She wasn't a project. She was a storm, sharp, sarcastic, restless in her own skin. She had this nervous laugh, always a half second too late, like her brain was running through 6 scripts before choosing the wrong one on purpose. Camille didn't flirt. She baited, mocked, disarmed. The first night we met, she told me I had serial killer eyes and asked if I believed in God in the same breath. I liked her immediately, but more importantly, I knew she'd be the perfect subject for the next experiment. It started the way it always does. With attention. Real, focused attention. I let her talk for hours. Listened without interrupting. Reacted just enough to reflect interest, but never too much. When she said something sad, I didn't console. When she said something funny, I didn't laugh too hard. I wanted her off balance. Always searching for the next cue. Over time, I noticed her tells. She scratched the inside of her palm when she lied. Bit her lower lip when she doubted herself. Stared too long when she didn't know what else to say. And she always apologized. For things that didn't matter. For things I made her feel. That was my in. It began subtly. She'd say, "Sorry, I talked too much." And I'd reply, "Did you even say anything worth remembering?" She'd blink, laugh, then frown. But I always followed it with a kiss. Or a compliment. Or both. Confusion. Reassurance. Contradiction. That's the gaslight gospel. Create uncertainty. Then become the only source of comfort. Soon, I started rewriting small moments. If she brought up something I said that upset her, I'd say, "I never said that. You probably misunderstood me." Or, "You always remember things wrong when you're emotional." If she questioned my behavior, I'd act wounded. Hurt by her lack of trust. Offended she'd even bring it up. And when she apologized, God, she always apologized. I'd hold her face, look her in the eyes, and whisper, "It's okay. I know your memory plays tricks on you sometimes." And it worked. Of course it did. Because gaslighting doesn't need to erase the truth. It only needs to make the truth feel fragile. You destabilize it. And once it starts shaking, everything else follows. One night, we had a fight. It wasn't even real. I staged it. Pretended to be upset that she'd flirted with some guy at a bar. She hadn't. I knew she hadn't. But I planted the idea anyway. You were smiling at him. I wasn't. You touched his arm. No, I didn't. Camille, I watched it happen. She stared at me, her voice cracking. I think you saw it wrong. But I didn't. I saw it perfectly. She started crying. And I held her, shushed her, told her I forgave her. For something she didn't even do. That night, she fell asleep in my arms. Her breath was shaky. Her heartbeat louder than the silence. I could feel the shift. She no longer trusted herself. She only trusted me. Weeks passed, and I escalated. If she laughed too loudly with a friend, I'd go quiet for hours. If she forgot a detail in a story, I'd say, "You always do this." If she remembered things differently than I did, I'd gaslight her into paralysis. "You sure that's how it went? God, you always twist things. Maybe write it down next time so you don't forget." She started journaling her life. Every text, every call, every moment. She'd show me her notes and ask, "This happened, right?" And I'd smile and say, "That's not how I remember it." Eventually, I introduced the idea that she was mentally unstable. Carefully, lovingly, like a gift. "I read this article today," I told her, "about trauma-linked memory distortion." Her eyes lit up. "Really?" "Yeah. It reminded me of you." Then I hugged her, kissed the top of her head, held her tighter than ever before. She wept, told me she was scared of herself, that she was thankful to have me. And I whispered, "I'll always help you remember what's real." She gave me her passwords, let me read her diary, asked me to monitor her reactions. Sometimes even asked me to tell her what to feel. That's the end game of gaslighting. When someone gives you full access to their perception, you no longer need to control them. They'll control themselves for you. But here's the part one didn't expect. Camille stopped being fun. Once she broke, she stopped pushing back. Stopped questioning. Stopped being her. She became quiet. Timid. Afraid to speak unless she was sure I'd agree. And I started to hate her for it. Not because she changed. Because I had made her that way. And now that she was hollow, she no longer held my interest. One night, she asked me, "Do you think I'm losing my mind?" I looked at her for a long time, and I almost told her the truth. Almost. Instead, I said, "I think you just need to trust me more." She nodded, like it was a prayer, like I was God. I ended things 3 weeks later, told her it wasn't working, that I felt smothered. that her emotional instability was affecting my well-being. She didn't cry. She just stared at me and said, "Maybe I made you up too." That was the last thing she ever said to me, and I'll never forget it. People think gaslighting is about lies, but it's not. It's about replacing someone's entire internal compass with you. So when they finally realize they're lost, they don't look for a map. They look for you to tell them which way is north. Chapter 5, The Puppet Strings. Technique: emotional dependency, intermittent reinforcement, and control through reward withdrawal. You don't have to chain a person to keep them still. You just have to teach them that every step away from you hurts more than staying. If gaslighting is about altering someone's sense of reality, then this is about altering their sense of self, not erasing it, just reprogramming it, one reward at a time. Her name was Sienna, not a project, not an experiment, not at first. She was different. She came into my life like a shot of adrenaline, fast, bright, messy. She was the kind of girl who laughed with her whole chest, who argued for sport, who told me on our second conversation that I was weirdly magnetic and probably dangerous, and then kissed me like she wanted to find out how deep the damage went. She was self-aware. She wasn't broken. She wasn't quiet. She had sharp edges and made sure you felt every one of them. Which is why, when I broke her, I did it slowly, because Sienna wouldn't shatter all at once. She had to be softened first. Our first month together was fire. Real fire. Lust, banter, constant motion. Nights that blurred into mornings. Conversations that bled into philosophy, politics, and childhood trauma. We were two storm systems colliding. No one was in control. That was the magic. But magic is only temporary. What I wanted wasn't chaos. It was structure. What I needed was obedience, delivered willingly. What I craved was control disguised as love. So I started building the strings. String number one, praise. I praised her like a sculptor praises his clay. "You're different. No one's ever made me feel this scene. You've got this energy, it's addictive." Not all the time. Just enough. Enough to make her chase the next compliment like a junkie chasing a high. She'd light up every time I said something kind. But I never repeated the same praise twice. That's the secret. Repetition breeds expectation. Scarcity breeds obsession. If she said something brilliant, I'd smile but stay silent. Let her stew in the silence. Then, hours later, I'd whisper, "You really blew my mind today." By then, she'd already convinced herself I was disappointed. So when the compliment finally came, it landed like oxygen. String number two, withdrawal. After every peak came the pullback. We'd spend a weekend wrapped in each other, sex, laughter, confessions. And then I'd go cold for 3 days. No texts, no replies, just absence. And when I came back, I'd act like nothing happened. When she asked, "Where'd you go?" I'd say, "I needed time to think. You're a lot sometimes." She'd apologize. She'd say, "Sorry for being intense. Sorry if I pushed too hard. Sorry I'm too much." I never asked for those apologies, but I created the conditions that forced them. That's what dependency looks like. Them blaming themselves for your silence. String number three, personal reward systems. I created rituals, emotional reward loops. Every time she did something I liked, I'd touch her differently. Say her name with softness. Make her feel like she was winning me. If she challenged me too hard, I'd pull away. Become distant, cold, disinterested. She started noticing. "If I don't agree with you, you shut down." I laughed. "Sienna, come on. I love that you challenge me." But I didn't. I punished her for it every time. And she learned. Quietly. Slowly. To comply. People always think compliance looks like obedience. It doesn't. It looks like adjustment. Tiny edits in tone. Softening a sentence before it's spoken. Holding back a truth because the silence afterward is too unbearable. That's what I trained Sienna into. And the best part? She thought she was evolving, becoming a better partner, less reactive. She journaled her growth. "I used to lash out, but now I take a breath. I used to demand answers, but I've learned to give him space." She wrote me poems about the patients I taught her. And every time I read one, I smiled to myself and thought, good girl. But the thing about puppets is, eventually, they start hearing the strings. One night, she snapped. We were at dinner. She reached for my hand. I didn't respond. She asked if I was okay. I said I was tired. She smiled, but her eyes searched my face like it held a map she was too afraid to read. Then, out of nowhere, she said, you only touch me when I agree with you. Silence. I raised an eyebrow. What? I've noticed, she said, voice tight. If I push back, you get distant. If I nod and smile, you hold me. More silence. She shook her head. You're training me. And there it was. The crack in the programming. The spark of rebellion. I leaned in, touched her fingers gently, and said, Sienna, if you really believe that, then I think you're projecting something onto me that isn't there. Her lip trembled. But what if I'm not? I smiled. Soft. Reassuring. Then I'm sorry you feel that way. And just like that, she doubted herself again. The next day, she made me breakfast in bed. No questions. No accusations. Just quiet devotion. Because pulling the string tighter always works after it almost snaps. The truth is, I didn't want Sienna to disappear. I liked her spark, her fire, her fight. But I wanted it on a dimmer switch. Controlled. Predictable. Mine. So I fed her emotional breadcrumbs. One moment of affection. One night of closeness. One whispered, I need you. And she stayed. Because people don't leave when you're always just one good day away from the version of you they fell for. But I grew tired. As always. Because once someone becomes fully conditioned, once they start anticipating the rewards, calculating the punishments, they lose their mystery. Sienna, my little firestorm, became a trained animal. I pulled a string. She moved. I went silent. She cried. I praised her. She bloomed. It was beautiful and boring. So I did what I always do. I picked a fight I didn't care about. I turned off the light. I cut the strings. And I watched her fall. She begged once. Just once. Please don't go. I'll do better. And all I said was, I need someone who doesn't need so much. And then I walked away. Not because I wanted to, but because I had nothing left to take from her. Puppets stop dancing when the music stops. And I'd already written the last note. Chapter 6. No one leaves clean. Technique. Guilt tripping, moral framing, and victimhood as control. I used to think control came from power. The louder voice. The sharper mind. The stronger will. But that was amateur thinking. Real control? It doesn't scream. It whispers from the bottom of a wound. It says, you hurt me. You betrayed me. You should feel bad for what you did to me. And just like that, the one who broke them becomes the one bleeding. Guilt is the great equalizer. Even the strongest people, hell, especially the strongest, fall to it. Because the moment you make someone feel like a monster for protecting themselves, they'll hand you their freedom just to feel forgiven. Her name was Nora. She was supposed to be a break, a breath, a detour from the weight of what I'd become. But Nora, she was the one that almost saw everything. The one that, if I hadn't caught it in time, might have unmasked me. She was light in the way people talk about light. Glowing, laughing, disarming. A photographer. She captured what people wanted to believe about themselves. And when she turned the lens on me, I almost believed it too. Almost. We met at a friend's art exhibit. I hated being there. Too many pseudo-intellectuals, drunk on wine and self-importance. But Nora, she stood out. Not because she was loud, but because she was quiet in the way that commanded attention. When she looked at you, it felt like she was already picturing you as a story worth telling. And I crave that. Because when someone like me lives in the shadows long enough, even lies start aching for light. We started spending time together. Coffee runs turned into midnight walks. Conversations turned into sleep. Sleep turned into sex. Sex turned into something else, something harder to name. Nora wasn't naive. She asked questions. She noticed patterns. You vanish sometimes, she said one night. And when you come back, It's like nothing happened. I brushed it off, said I'd been going through things. She nodded, didn't press, but I saw it in her eyes. Doubt, concern, intuition. And that's when I knew. If I wanted to keep her, I couldn't dominate her. I had to make her feel responsible for me. It started with a story. One night, lying in bed, I told her about my mother. Told her she used to scream through walls, throw plates that shattered like promises. Told her I was the child who cleaned it up in silence every goddamn time. Some of it was true, some of it wasn't. But the point wasn't the truth. The point was the reaction. Nora's eyes filled with tears. She reached for me like she wanted to fix what was already fossilized. And I let her. I began dropping more fragments. Little landmines of pain. My ex said I was emotionally manipulative. My therapist thinks I dissociate during conflict. I'm scared I'll ruin this. Each confession, a calculated blow to her heart. Each pause, a hook in her conscience. I made her feel like she was the only one who could save me. And when she started pulling back, just a little, I acted like it broke me. "You're distant lately," I said. "You don't look at me the same." "I'm trying my best. Why isn't that enough?" She'd blink, shake her head, say, "No, no, it's not you. I'm just overwhelmed." But the guilt was already bleeding through her skin. Guilt is a currency. Spend it right, and they'll pay you in loyalty. I escalated, started questioning her love for me. Not loudly, quietly, with subtle barbs. "If you really loved me, you'd be more patient. If I mattered, you wouldn't shut down every time I open up. I know I'm a lot. I get it. Maybe I should just stop trying." The worst part? She started believing it. She apologized for things she never did. She texted me first, every time. She walked on eggshells, then vacuumed the shards. She even canceled a photography job out of town because she thought I might spiral if she left. And all I had to do was act a little broken. Here's what most people don't understand. Manipulators don't always act strong. Sometimes we act weak, wounded, vulnerable, because that's the mask that gets you closest to the jugular. It says, "Love me, heal me, don't abandon me." And the more they sacrifice themselves for you, the less of themselves they have left. But Nora was different. Not because she caught on, because she broke early. One night we had a fight, real this time. I told her I needed space. She said she felt used. I told her she was ungrateful. She said I was rewriting things again. I told her she was being selfish. She said, "I don't know who I am anymore." And I realized I'd gone too far. Not because I hurt her, because I'd made her useless to me. A broken doll is only fun to play with until the head falls off. Nora was unraveling, tired, unresponsive, quiet in a way that wasn't strong anymore. And I hated it. I needed her alive to reflect my illusion, not limp in my arms like a mirror too cracked to show me anything. So I staged a breakup, told her it was my fault, told her I was toxic, told her she deserved better. And when she started crying, begging me to stay, I played the martyr, whispered, "This is why I have to go. Because I make the people I love feel like this." And just like that, I walked out the hero. Weeks later, I got a message from her. Just four words. "You weren't broken. You were hungry." I didn't reply. Because she was right. I wasn't looking for love. I was looking for fuel. That's what guilt does. It makes people light themselves on fire. Just to keep you warm. Chapter 7. The Final Switch. Technique. Identity collapse, meta-manipulation, and reversing the mirror. You'd think after all I did, after all the lies, the games, the strings I pulled and snipped and burned, I'd feel like a god. But gods don't look over their shoulders. And I do, every fucking day. Because somewhere along the line, I forgot who I was before the mask fit too well. You wear something long enough. Eventually, it wears you. This isn't a story about a villain who gets what he deserves. It's about a man who looked into too many mirrors and saw nothing looking back. And if you're still here, still listening, then maybe you're not here for justice either. Maybe you just want to know how it ends. So here it is. Let me take you back to the moment everything collapsed. Let me tell you about Ari. Ari wasn't a girl I seduced, or a therapist I manipulated, or a case study in emotional dependency. Ari was a client. I'd started doing freelance consulting under the radar. People paid me in cash to read others, help win relationships, deals, influence. It wasn't ethical, but it was lucrative. Ari came to me with a simple request. "My sister's married to a narcissist," she said. "I need to pull her out." I asked questions, dug deep, listened for inconsistencies. And what I found was, she wasn't wrong. The husband? Textbook gaslighter. Charming in public. Cruel in private. Emotional reward-punishment cycles. Control disguised as care. I laid out the framework, explained the tactics, gave Ari the blueprint to help her sister escape. But the more I spoke, the more her eyes darkened. Not with fear, with recognition. "You know this too well," she said one afternoon. I shrugged. "It's pattern recognition. Psychology." She smiled, but it wasn't soft. "No, you don't just understand this. You live it." And that was the first time in years. I felt like prey instead of predator. She started digging into me after that. Not obviously, not aggressively, but with surgical precision. She'd make offhand comments like, "Funny, you always phrase things like the victim." Or, "Your stories sound like rehearsed empathy." And every time I tried to shift the subject, she'd steer it right back. Gently, deliberately, until one night, she said something that cracked the whole world open. "You don't manipulate people for control, Isaac. You do it because you're terrified they'll see the real you. And you hate that you don't even know who that is anymore." I didn't respond. Because I couldn't. Because somewhere inside, she was right. The people I manipulated weren't just victims. They were masks I wore, roles I rehearsed, versions of myself I built and broke over and over just to feel something. And Ari saw through all of it. That should have been the end. But it wasn't. Because Ari didn't walk away. She kept meeting with me, kept asking questions, kept pushing deeper into the hollow space I called my psyche. And for the first time, I started answering honestly. Not to impress, not to control, not to build trust, just to stop feeling like a fucking ghost. Weeks passed, and something strange happened. I stopped performing. When I said I didn't sleep, I meant it. When I said I used people, I didn't sugarcoat it. And she never looked away. Not once. "You're not evil," she said one night. "You're scared." And I didn't argue, because I was scared of being loved for something real. Scared of being abandoned once the act ended. Scared that nothing behind the mask was worth keeping. And then, she flipped the switch. She invited me to a small gathering. Casual. Just a few of her friends. I went. Thought nothing of it. Had a beer. Smiled when spoken to. Laughed when it felt right. Then someone asked me, "So how do you know Ari?" And before I could answer, she said, "Oh, he's been helping me understand abusers. He was one." The room went still. I stared at her. She smiled. I excused myself. Went to the bathroom. Closed the door. And stared at my face in the mirror. But this time, I didn't recognize who was staring back. Because I had no control. No angle. No leverage. She didn't just call me out. She outed me. In a room full of strangers. And smiled while doing it. I didn't speak to her for weeks. Didn't reply to her messages. Didn't respond when she texted. I told the truth. That's what you always wanted, right? But I couldn't stop thinking about her. Not out of anger. Out of awe. Because for the first time, someone used my own playbook against me. And it worked. That's when I realized I wasn't the master manipulator. I was just a mirror, reflecting what people wanted, bending to their desires, twisting to survive. And Ari, she didn't want to be mirrored. She wanted to shatter the glass. The final switch wasn't a plan. It wasn't a scheme. It was a reckoning. Because when you spend your life rearranging other people's realities, eventually, yours collapses too. You want to know what happened after that? I stopped consulting. Stopped dating. Stop talking, really. I spent months in silence, trying to figure out what I actually believed. What feelings were mine and what were copied. What memories were true and what were rewritten so many times they felt like lies. I started writing this story, not for sympathy, not for redemption, but to see if I still knew how to tell the truth. And here it is, the truth. I was a manipulator, a puppeteer, a surgeon of self-worth. And I bled every person I touched until they forgot how to breathe without asking me first. But I'm also something else now, not better, just aware. And that's the first real step anyone ever takes. Even if it's late, even if it's ugly, even if you've burned every bridge behind you, there's still one truth left. The last person I manipulated was me.